5 major ballot proposals are heading to voters this November. Changes that could alter the pace of development, the balance of power between City Hall and the Council, and even how everyday New Yorkers engage in local democracy. Supporters say these reforms will cut red tape, boost housing production, and modernize city government. Critics warn they could weaken local input and concentrate decision-making in fewer hands. So today we're joined by Basha Gerhartz, Executive Vice President of Public Policy here at REBNY, to break down how these proposals came to be, what they could mean for housing and planning in New York, and what's at stake when voters head to the polls this November. Basha, welcome to Real Talk NYC. Let's get real about the 2025 ballot proposals.
Thank you, Grace, for having me today.
Of course. So for people who haven't followed this closely, what exactly are the ballot proposals voters will see in November, and why are they such a big deal for New York City's future?
So to take a step back, the Charter Revision Commission, this is a commission that is charged with looking at New York City's local constitution, so to speak. And the Charter Revision Commission was convened in December 2024 by Mayor Eric Adams to really focus in on the barriers to housing production within New York City. We are in the midst of a 50-year housing emergency, a crisis that is marked by a lack of supply. So the proposals that folks will see when they flip over their ballot from the mayoral contenders. There's also city council races. A lot of positions are up within the city for election this November, including comptroller, public advocate, and borough president races. So when you flip over on the other side, you will see 6 ballot proposals. And 5 of those ballot proposals 2 through 6, are the result of the Charter Revision Commission.
So why did the Charter Revision Commission focus so heavily on housing and land use this cycle?
When we talk about our 50-year-plus housing emergency, when we say that this is a crisis of supply, what we're really referring to is year-over-year, New York City job growth, population growth has trended upwards. But we've pretty much have stayed static from a housing production perspective, which means we're not matching our housing production to the amount of people who are coming in and working and living in New York City. And that creates a deficit over time. The mayor and governor identified a 500,000 unit production goal over the next decade in order to address this deficit and ensure we have sufficient supply or, you know, apartments and choice for the people who live and work and want to come to New York and live and work to make sure people have choices. And right now we don't have that choice because we don't have enough supply. And that's why we have a citywide vacancy rate of 1.41%. And that is the lowest it's been since 1968.
Wow. So focusing on ballot proposals 2 through 6, as you said, I wonder if we could just sort of run through what each one says.
Yes. So ballot proposal 2 refers to the idea of affordable housing not going to certain council members and the process ending sooner at the City Planning Commission. And when I say process, I'm referring to the city's Uniform Land Use Review Procedure, or ULURP. And ULURP is the city's land use process. This was a process that was instituted in the last major Charter Revision Commission in 1989. So this is the process we've had since 1989. If someone wants to build something that requires what we refer to as discretionary approvals, that discretionary process means they go to the local community board, they go to the affected borough president, the project then goes to the City Planning Commission and ends at the City Council. What ballot proposal 2 is saying, we're going to end that process earlier. We're going to end it with the City Planning Commission. And we're ending it earlier, not for every community board, but only for those community boards where over the last really 2 decades, they have produced the least amount of housing as compared to the rest of the city. And that's really important when we think about this housing supply crisis. It's not just a crisis of supply. It's also a number of neighborhoods have not been contributing their fair share. And how entrenched is that power structure to ensure no new housing and therefore no new people move into that neighborhood?
Interesting. I see these are very focused, as you said, on housing production. So then what is number 3?
Number 3. Number 3 is known as ELURP. You know, we really love our acronyms in the planning and land use space. So that it refers to the expedited land use review procedure. The idea behind this ballot proposal is to move or allow for certain projects that currently have to go through that full process. Again, community board, borough president, city planning commission, city council, to have a shorter process. A shorter process does not mean there's no community input. Shorter process does not mean that there's not an examination of environmental review criteria in terms of what kind of impact may this type of project have from an infrastructure perspective or a school seat perspective. But it's acknowledging over time, certain projects tend to not have those types of impacts. And therefore, should we right-size the land use process to the environmental review process with the recognition that what the ballot proposal refers to as modest-sized projects don't have the same impacts as a 1,000-unit proposal. And I want to draw that distinction. Most projects that go through ULURP, they're asking for increases of density of 40% or more, nearly all of them in the last decade. That's because the ULURP process, this public review process, is a gauntlet. It is time intensive. It is cost intensive. And it means a lot of people are locked out of the development process. More, I would say, smaller developers, smaller sites, more you know, someone wants to build 20 units instead of 10 units, but the zoning doesn't quite allow that. They have to go through the same process as someone who wants to go from a manufacturing lot to a high-density residential district.
I see. Sort of an attempt at a more efficient process, I guess. Okay, moving along. What's the next one?
All right. So the next one is known as the Zoning Appeals Board. Currently today in the public review process, after it ends at the city council, technically the mayor has a 5-day veto period to override the city council's decision. That power is, I would want to say, you never want to say never, but has not been used in quite some time. And whatever the council decides is the final decision. Everywhere else in the country, when you look at or you think about process, there's always an appeals component. If you don't agree with the decision, you should have the right to go to someone else and say, hey, can we reexamine this based on the facts? We don't have that in the land use process. And this is also why it's only the most well-resourced or the largest projects that tend to go through ULURP because of that gauntlet and because you risk if you're turned down, there's no way to appeal that decision. So the Zoning Appeals Board would replace the mayoral 5-day veto with a 3-person board. That 3-person board would comprise of a representative from the city council, the City Planning Commission, and the affected borough president. Currently, in today's process, the borough president only has an advisory role. This was a power that was actually taken away from them in 1989. Prior to 1989, the borough presidents had more of a formal role through the Board of Estimate to veto and approve projects. Today, it's advisory. So this veto, this change in the veto, this creation of the Zoning Appeals Board actually gives power back to the borough president, gives more local or borough-wide lens or power back than what we've had since 1989. But it actually does diminish power from two sources. It takes away the mayor. It refers it back to the City Planning Commission. The chair of the City Planning Commission, while a mayoral appointee, is appointed with, they are supposed to meet certain criteria. That's an independent body, like any of the mayoral boards or chairs. And the city council still has a voice. The Zoning Appeals Board will require 2 out of 3 to vote to overturn the city council decision.
Gotcha. And then the last one is about moving elections to even-numbered years, right?
Well, before we get to that, everyone forgets about the city map proposal.
Okay.
It's a very, the poor city map. It's very important to me. And I hope it will be important to New Yorkers. For a lot of the work that we do at REBNY or in the public policy space, or when you're thinking about zoning and land use, or you're thinking about other changes to the zoning resolution, right? It's our elected officials who are making those decisions fundamentally through the city council, through the appointments in the community boards, through the mayoral, borough president, city council appointments to the city planning commission. But these ballot proposals are ballot proposals that New York voters can weigh in on, and you can decide how you want to rebalance the decision-making powers within the land use process. So before we get to even year elections, the last, I would say, proposal directly related to housing and land use is about the city map. Today, the city map is housed across each of the 5 borough president's offices. That means the maps for Manhattan are housed with the Manhattan Borough President's office in a room, hard copies. Every time someone needs to change the city grade or the height of the street, and you want to do things like this, say in Queens, where you're seeing a lot more rainy day flooding, and you want to go in and create, say, a slope for the street so the street doesn't flood and emergency workers can continue to, and vehicles can continue to go down that street. To do all of that, one, it has to go through a full ULURP. And then the city map change itself, right, goes through a bifurcated process. So because the borough presidents house the city maps, they weigh in before the land use process starts and they weigh in during the land use process. And then they have to sign and hold the maps themselves. So the ballot proposal 5 would centralize, which is kind of wild when you think about that we don't actually have that. The city map is not centralized. It's spread across the 5 boroughs in 5 different offices and 5 different rooms or multiple rooms. Centralize that and digitize it. So very technical, actually quite important when you think about planning for the future of the city. So no one please forget about ballot proposal 5.
Well said. Okay, so now we could talk about number 6, which is about local elections.
So ballot proposal 6 is about moving elections to even years. When this has been done in other municipalities, it boosts turnout. A lot of when we think again about who's making decisions, whether it's legislation, land use decisions, housing decisions, a number of council races are sometimes won by double digits. And you only have a couple of hundred people turn out to decide who the council member is that's going to weigh in whether housing gets built in that council district through the discretionary process. So moving elections to even years, it's been shown in, again, across the country and across many municipalities to boost turnout because it means people are coming out for the federal races along with the more local races. Now, what that requires is state enabling action, and that state enabling action through the state constitution was already voted on and was subject to a judicial challenge. That judicial challenge has been resolved. The other thing to keep in mind with ballot proposal 6 and the moving to even years is every time the city is doing a, running an election, they have to have the voting booths and you're paying the poll workers. This costs $42 million each time. So when we talk about city resources and what we want to use our city resources on, if we combine into even years, we're going to spend less money on the administrative part of running the elections. And there's a lot of things I can think of that we'd like to spend that money on, especially housing.
Wow. Okay, thanks for that overview. Now I want to talk about implications. If these measures pass, what do you think the real-world impact would look like?
With most of the work we do when we're talking about removing barriers to housing on the regulatory side, I caution patience. This will not be an overnight change. Our development process, unfortunately, is up to 2 times longer than anywhere else in the country. Changes like this could be viewed as modest in of itself, but it's really about viewing it holistically with what other changes are being made. City of Yes for Housing Opportunity was a major zoning change, largest rewrite of the zoning resolution since 1961. Creation of tax incentives by the state to encourage, say, office to residential conversions or for new construction. Time will tell how effective those tax benefits are or in terms of encouraging housing production, but we're seeing really encouraging signs from 467M for office to residential conversions. All of these pieces in combination is what allows for housing production to move forward. So I don't want to say, oh, tomorrow that things will be better, but this is about setting us up for success over the long term. And the changes that were made in 1989 to the charter revision when it came to the land use process, we're still in a housing emergency and it's time to try something else.
What do you think this moment says about where New York is heading in terms of housing, planning, governance? I mean, could these proposals mark the start of a bigger shift in how the city grows and operates?
I think for those of us who are in the public policy space and are looking at what the legislative landscape or the regulatory landscape is when it comes to housing. 5 years ago, I would say most people who were in the position to make policy changes, I would almost qualify them as supply skeptics. We don't need more housing, very focused on tenant rights. It's not that we shouldn't be focused on tenant rights, but we need, when you think about like the theory of abundance and that's now more of the conversation. It's what do we need to do in 3 different buckets? And I would say those 3 different buckets are how do we boost housing supply? And that has 2 pieces to it, right? That's both bringing down the cost of construction and improving the regulatory environment to facilitate or encourage production itself. The second piece is really about the operations of the existing building stock. What are we doing from a public policy perspective to reduce expenses and ensure reinvestment in those buildings so that they stay in a state of good repair for the tenants who live in them? And then the third bucket, and again, different policy entities will have different priorities, but from a tenant perspective, what are we doing to help people pay the rent? What are we doing to make sure people have equal representation in judicial processes? And I would say also for tenants, I think I would hope housing quality is important to the tenant advocates as well. And across those three spaces, when I look at what has been happening from a public policy perspective, I hope this is one of many changes that it will occur over the next several years to boost housing supply, address the quality of our existing buildings and operating expense growth, and make sure our tenants and New Yorkers are stably housed for the future.
Well said. Thanks so much, Basha.
Thanks for having me today, Grace. And folks, don't forget to vote, please.
Election Day is November 4th. You can find information about where and how to vote at vote.nyc. And of course, don't forget to flip over your ballot and vote on the charter revisions. Real Talk NYC is produced by the Real Estate Board of New York. Today's episode was edited and hosted by Grace Boak with help from Jason Ryan. Thanks for listening.